All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. This is part two of the podcast with Michael Clayton of OCCM Golf Course Design. Michael, thank you for joining me again for part two. Really appreciate the time.
Pleasure, Anthony.
We had finished a conversation on yesterday on the radio show, and I had sort of teased and about you had basically written an article, and you brought up the idea that it was no coincidence that Americans had come up with the idea of McDonald's in a reference to an article that escapes me at the moment. But I wonder if you could elaborate that. I think it was in reference to really the pro game, but I just thought it was an interesting analogy, and I was hoping that you could elaborate on that a little bit more.
Wow, did we talk about McDonald's yesterday?
No, I sort of teased it in the when I was doing the end of the show. I remember reading an article. I couldn't remember it. It escapes me now. But I had teased it at the end of the radio show. That we were going to talk about golf and McDonald's. And I thought it was a reference that you had made in an article you had written. I wasn't sure if it was Golf Australia or not. And it was not you.
No, it probably was. No, it was probably about, I'm trying to think on what the context I would have used.
Well,
I
think the context was how professional golf, if I could, not that I want to speak for you, but it seemed to be in the article that really what you were referencing was the fact that that the idea of equity and the only way for, you know, and the idea of equity and this sort of, that sort of, I guess, morphed it into sameness. And so that
the sameness, yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
so, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So pre-McDonald's in Australia, we had the Greeks and Italians who migrated after the war came out, and many, many of them opened fish and chip shops based on English fish and chips, actually, but they made hamburgers, and every one you went to was slightly different. They were great, but they were different. And then in the 70s, I guess McDonald's came here, and the trademark of McDonald's was that no matter where you went in the world, every McDonald's hamburger was exactly the same.
Right.
So I'm not sure if that's a fair answer. That's probably pretty reasonable. So every Hilton hotel you go to and every, you know, Holiday Inn, no matter where you go, they're all pretty much the same. Nothing surprises you ever.
Yeah.
So,
no. Oh, go ahead.
It seemed to me like the setup of golf courses in America, and this is a massive generalization, because clearly Cypress Point and the National Golf Links and Shinnecock and Seminole and all those great old courses don't kind of follow this, but it seemed like the fairways would be a standard width, and there would be a very standard way of cutting the rough. So there'd be one or two or three step cuts of rough, and often, you know, it always amazed me that coming from a place where, you know, the bunkers cut all the way to the edge of the greens, there'd often be sort of two paces of rough and different heights of rough between the edge of the green and the bunkers. So the rough was essentially stopping the ball going in the bunkers. But there was a very standardized, formulaic way of setting up golf courses. And, I mean, I've never played the tour in America, so perhaps it's disingenuous of me to comment too much about it. But, you know, I think Jeff Ogilvie would say that you see very, you know, very similar philosophies on the setup every or most weeks, where, as I said, the fairways will be a predictable width and the rough is very much a part of the game, whereas it's not so much a part of the game in Britain or Australia. I mean, there are off fairway areas that aren't fairway, but they're certainly not as cut and cut with the aim of being as predictable as the rough is in America, where, going to your point about equity of punishment, is that golf pros want to know that the guy who misses the fairway by 3 feet gets that lie, and the guy who misses in the next 6 feet gets that lie, and the guy who misses in the next 20 yards gets that lie. So everyone who misses the shot the same gets the same lie, pretty much. So
right.
it's entirely predictable, and that sounds like a logical way to set the game of golf up, except that for me, I think that great courses are that stuff is much more random, and a part of dealing with the randomness and the unfairness of the game epitomized nowhere better than St. Andrews, which is the most unfair course of them all. And I say that in a complimentary way, mm-hmm. is that the mental challenge of golf is dealing with its inherent unfairness. Because at the end of the the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the year, and at the end of someone's career, I think that pretty much what they would what most players would describe as good and bad luck is going to finish up around 50-50. They'll get 50% good draws, 50% bad ones. They'll get 50-50 good bounces, bad bounces, good lies, bad lies. You know, and it'll pretty much be the same for every player, and it'll even out over the course of whatever, the week, the day, the month, the year, the career. So to try and beat that out of the game is a mistake, I think, because you finish up with entirely predictable, consistent, fair setups, and that's not what I don't think the game is about when it's at its best. You know, I think it's more random than that.
Well, I agree, and I don't want to get into – I mean, it's easy to point the finger at the big money in golf, and understandably, you know, I mean, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the tour sends out specifications to its future sites.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, so there's your McDonald's, and is the evidence of McDonald's, I guess, if you will. But I wanted to – but really, what I think your McDonald's analogy or metaphor, if you will, is spot on, only in the sense that that's what's wrong with McDonald's, right? That McDonald's is the problem is consistency.
Yeah,
you don't want consistency in your food, right? You want your food to be different. Like,
well,
not, you know, well, I feel like, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Well, I think that, I mean, Starbucks came to Australia.
Right.
And went broke and packed up and went back to America because people just said, this is just junk, this stuff. I mean, because we have so many, but again, bought out by the Italians mainly after the war. We have great coffee shops. And when Starbucks came out, Starbucks, as I said, packed up and went back to America. But McDonald's succeeded wildly. I mean, kids love McDonald's.
Right.
But it always amazed me that, well, the local guy down the road was always making better hamburgers than they were.
Sure.
But you could go there, and as we've been talking about, you knew exactly what you were going to get. And the quality was what it was, and they mightn't have been the best hamburgers, but they were, no matter where you went, that's what you got.
Yeah.
And no matter where, you know, I think it was Ben Crenshaw, he said a quote something like, the game would be entirely boring if two players could hit the same shot and not come up with different results. And that, again, it sounds ridiculous, but, mm-hmm. you know, two players ought to be able to be on the last hole of a PGA Tour event, and they both hit the same drive that goes marginally down the edge of the fairway, and they get two entirely different lies.
Yeah.
But if you spoke to every single one of the 125 exempt players on the PGA Tour, 124, because Jeff Ogilvy wouldn't say that, 124 of 125 would say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, everyone should have the same punishment. And that, again, sounds perfectly logical, except the whole challenge is how the player deals with that.
Yeah,
and it's in trying to achieve that sameness, all you achieve is blandness and boringness, and you know you don't get the look when Bill Corr came out to Royal Melbourne. He said, "I just love how scruffy this place is." And again, to many, scruffy would sound like a derogatory comment. Yet mm-hmm. he was saying, "I love how scruffy this place is. It's a beautiful, natural, scruffy look." Yet many American golfers, and again, I'm generalizing, wouldn't accept that because, hell, they're paying a fortune to be a member of the X, Y, and Z country club, and they don't want scruffy, they want perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the game goes down the track of, especially at the, you know, often the most expensive places, they want perfect conditions, whereas I don't think the game is predicated on perfection either. I mean, there's a big difference. I play at Metropolitan, which is where the World Cup is this year.
Uh-huh.
They played the World Match Play there in 2001, and where Steve Stricker won. And many players came out and said, these are the best fairways in the world. And I've played there since they redid the fairways in the mid-80s, I can honestly say that every single lie I've had in the intervening 25 years has been identical.
Mm-hmm.
Every single lie.
Mm-hmm.
You never consider how the ball's lying because it's always lying perfectly.
Right.
So that to me is a perfect surface. And the superintendent gets full marks for that. But is that perfect for golf? You know, I mean, I would say that Bumboogle here in Australia, which is pure fescue, so and all those great links in Britain, that it's perfect turf for golf. but you'll get lots of variations and lots of subtle variations in the lies, where the ball might, you know, sits in a lower spot where the mower hasn't quite gotten to it, so it's a little cup here, or it's on a mound that hasn't had so much water, so it's drier, and you're always considering how the ball's lying.
Right.
Most golfers who played Metropolitan would think these are the best throws in the world because every lie is exactly the same.
Right.
But is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's a great technical feat in grass growing, but I don't necessarily think it's perfect for golf.
Yeah,
I think the game needs a variety of subtly different lies, because it brings out the player who can judge how the ball's going to come out of something that's slightly different.
Yeah, I think that in itself might be a whole show, because you're talking about, part of what you're talking about is conditioning, right? And the other part is playability and how the course is, if it's a perfect downhill lie, you know what I mean? If the undulations of the fairways, right? Is the grass perfectly laying on an uphill lie or a downhill lie or a downhill sidehill lie, right? So we could sort of break that apart, but I think we get into the idea of conditioning versus, you know, like you're saying, the randomness of even the conditioning is what you're talking about. And so that's a whole another ball game. My fear is that, or what I've seen is, this whole idea of the pro game has been trickled down to the expectations of what regular people should be playing, when it's like, you know, I liken it to the idea of, if the pro game is the supermodels, then we're a generation of kids with eating disorders trying to be, trying to be supermodels. And it's not even close to being the same. And so whether it's golf course setup or whether it's unrealistic expectations from golfers, but they have nowhere else to look other than the pro game. And that's sort of, I see, you know, even another problem with the game.
Well, of course, the issue is the expense. I mean, it costs, you know, how much it costs. I mean, how much that extra 10 or 15% extra in the condition of the golf course, how much that costs for the benefit? I mean, there's not that much benefit. Of course, it's 85% it's 85 out of 100 in terms of condition. Isn't that far off? Of course, it's 100 out of 100. But how much does that extra 15 cost?
Yeah.
In terms of wages and, you know, fertilizer and water, and of course, you know, there's the, I was at the Hoylake Open that Tiger won in 2006, and
sure,
I did some radio back here, and a friend of mine had a sports show in Melbourne. He said, "Oh, the course looks terrible on TV." I said, "I've never been to a tournament, but I've never heard one complaint about the golf course because it's in such perfect condition. It's just brown."
Right.
But lots of people hated the look of that golf course who weren't there. Yeah, it just felt perfect.
Right.
And 3 weeks later, when it rained, it went green. It was green again. So that's closer to how the game is meant to be. But there's such a reverence, you know, probably harks back a lot to Augusta, where there's that perfect, you know, green over the whole place. That green is seen as, that's what golf is supposed to be, is green. Because golf's supposed to be lots of different shades of browns and yellows and greens, and, you know, and not something to be manipulated, because, you know, green isn't the be-all and end-all. Because when it gets hot in the summer and the course burns off, then it changes colour. Well, that's a good thing, I think. And golf's going to have to certainly be more, certainly in Australia, and it has been in Australia, because water's a big issue down here. You know, golf's got to be aware of how much water it uses. And If you're watering a golf course to keep it alive, fine. But if you're watering it to keep it green, then you're using too much water.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because the color spectrum is a reflection of status. If it's green, well, you're of good status. If it's brown, well, you can't afford to keep your grass green.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So and unfortunately, I think, and that ties into, and I think part of the public, you know, as you well know, really doesn't know what's good for them in general. I mean, I think if people took more chances and educated their players and said, this is good for you, and this was going to make the game more fun, then I think more public courses should do it. But I think they're just afraid that if they start to do that and people don't understand, then people will stop coming to their golf course thinking that it's dying and they can't take it. They're on the brink of closing. So, and so it's just really, I wish that was, instead of this grow the game, I feel like we would be better served with if we educated the players, you know, educated the public, should be a bigger, a more important initiative than growing the game, because I think that's sort of a bunch of nonsense in some respects. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, so much of growing the game is from people with vested interest in the commercial realities of it.
Sure.
You know, I mean, sure, we don't want to shrink it, but
no.
I mean, just endlessly chasing new players is, I mean.
Well, it's we're trying to eat out of the same pie, and there's only so many ways you can slice the pie, and so we come up with these sort of, these new things. I mean, you think about how many people, when you think about the industry that golf has become between, you know, the grow the game initiatives to right down to the nutritionists, to the sports psychologists, to the fitness gurus, it's really incredible how many people are trying to sort of suck off the teat of golf and the industry that's golf, and that doesn't even count the fix your slice gadget that you can get that you see on TV. So it's really quite amazing that it's sustained that it's been able to sustain itself to this point.
It's staggering how much money is in golf. I mean, just and the inventions and the mad technology race to con people into thinking they've found an extra 5 yards with the latest driver, and it's just, it never ends. But I've always thought the game was better when you could do what Jack Nicklaus did and use the same three wood his whole career. I mean, that's now it's, there's a new model out I think the company's figured out that it wasn't too smart to be bringing out. But he'd tell them I'd bring out three drivers in 1 year, and each was better than the. And you can't tell me that TaylorMade and Titleist and Callaway haven't developed their driver for 2022. I mean, I'm sure it's sitting there waiting to come out. They just, they kind of drip feed them out. I mean, that's how I imagine they do it.
I imagine they do, and I imagine that's part of the reason why they don't want to roll back the ball, right? I mean, they don't want any, because that's sort of thinking about how far in advance they've got their R&D, how far they've gone, and they, that's invested dollars.
Yeah, the thing you wonder about is the R&A report the other day that showed the distance had gone up 3 yards or whatever in the last 5 years or whatever it was. I mean, you wonder that, if they have the technology to make the ball go 15 yards further, but they know they can't do it in one leap, so they do it, incrementally at 4 yards at a time, which Wally Ulam will accuse me of being a conspiracy theorist again, but I'm just a cynic when it comes to this stuff, and I hate to see what's happened to golf courses in terms of how they play versus how their designers intended them to play. So, you see two holes at Alistair McKenzie and Dan Souter, who was the original router of Kingston Heath in Melbourne. He played the World Cup last year. The 17th was a par 5, which changed to a par 4 in the 1960s because it's 435 metres, so 480 yards, perhaps a bit less. And it was a long blind second over the hill, and John Rahm drove it to the top of the hill. He drove it where he could see the green. He drove it at 60 yards off the green. I mean, if Alistair McKenzie came back and knew that a hole that he'd designed as a long two-shotter had been reduced to a drive and a sandwich, not even a sandwich, he would just go, it would be apoplectic at the R&A and the USGA for letting it get to that state.
Well,
Go
ahead.
Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
There you go.
I just think that, I think the idea of having a, and this goes for everything. I mean, it's very difficult to have a rational and sensible argument anymore because everybody has their agenda. Everybody has their, whatever it is that they're defending, for whatever reason they're defending, it doesn't matter because despite what is happening right in front of their eyes. So, I mean, it doesn't, you could argue until you're blue in the face, whatever way you want to argue. But the fact of the matter is, look how these guys are playing the game. I mean, it's not it's right in front of your eyes. It's not an illusion. So, and this idea of the ball, like, you know, the people have, you know, they've basically framed, you know, they framed this, the argument around the idea that the average guy like me is going to lose yards off my drive. Well, I mean, really, what am I losing? I mean, you know, I would rather them roll back the ball than put the loss back to what they used to be. I mean, that's where you'd really lose yardage. But if you're just talking about this ball and the swing speed, then just that alone, I mean, I'm barely getting the yards, whatever it is that the pro's getting anyway. If we're both using the Pro V1, and you dialed it back to, let's say, max out at 100 and, I don't know, 5 or 110 swing speed, or whatever that would equate to, well, I'm not achieving that anyway. So what am I losing? So you know, it's all a bunch of nonsense. But
yeah,
you know,
there are two issues there. The first is someone needs to do a test with the current ball and a rolled back ball, and they need to swing the thing on the driver on the iron barn, I assume they're still using that machine.
Yeah.
They need to swing it at 80 miles an hour and see what the difference is, 81, 82, 83, all the way through to 130. So people know how much they're losing. So if you're taking 30 yards off Dustin Johnson, which was what Jack Nicklaus suggested when he said 10%, you're not taking 30 yards off me or 30 yards off my mother-in-law. You're taking nothing off her.
Probably. Exactly.
Or, I might lose 5 yards. But a huge part of this problem is that it's an American-driven debate. They're American companies, Titleist, Callaway, TaylorMade, who are manufacturing all the golf balls. So they've got the loudest voice in that sphere. And because it's an American-driven debate, it's the great fear of the American amateur player that they're going to lose distance because they're going to roll the ball back. What most of them don't realize is that in the mid-80s, when America forced on the rest of the world the big ball, which was actually a great thing that happened, I think, the whole world outside of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, the ball was effectively rolled back 25 yards for the good players. I mean, Greg Norman, there was a period in Australia where both balls were legal. Well, both balls were always legal, but there was a period when the best young Australian players knew they were going to play in America and they would play with the big ball. And Peter Thompson would write in the paper saying, I don't understand why Greg Norman's giving up 20 yards this week by playing with the big size American ball. Which was a reasonable argument. But Greg's argument was, well, if I want to play in America, I'm going to have to learn to play with this golf ball, so I'm going to play with it. So the whole world, in theory, lost 25 yards in 1983 or whenever it was that the big ball became the universal ball of the game. And it was a good thing that it did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing to understand, that the game didn't end in Australia when the average guy at the club on the 1st of January 1983, teed off with a 1.68-inch ball, and his ball went 20 yards less or whatever it was. He didn't give up the game. No one gave up the game as far as I could see.
Well,
I
think part of that also is that it was the, you know, you're talking about when that happened. First of all, that was that pie that I was speaking of was a lot sort of not smaller, I guess, in the sense of it was the, let's say, pre-Tiger, right? And so, and what I mean by that really is that we also treated the game as it should be really treated now. We don't treat the game. The game is a niche sport, okay, and it always will be a niche sport. And to try to make it American football or football, your football or the NFL, right? It's never going to be those things. It's not that kind of sport. It's not that kind of profession. It's not that kind of game. And so it never will be. If they really treated it like it was, instead of trying to expand the pie as if like it could be something that it should treat it the game the way what it really is, instead of trying to make it something it's not.
Yeah, and then it's true. It's a niche sport in Australia too, in a sense, except it's the biggest participation sport in Australia also.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So more people play golf. Well, that, I'm leaving out walking, I think, but or perhaps fishing. But
right.
But certainly it's one of the two or three biggest participation sports in the country. So it's a, but only less than 10% of people play golf in Australia. But in terms of the overall sporting landscape, more people play golf than pretty much anything else, because every little country town's got a golf course. It's a, you know, it was a big social hub. You know, it's Australia's a big open country with, you know, lots of country towns in the middle of nowhere, and the golf club became a place where people got congregated and socialized and had fun and play, because it was pretty much the only recreation in those places. So it was a game that spread across the land, really. I suppose the same as it did in America. But, you know, whilst it's a niche game, it's still got a lot of participation in Australia. Oh. And a lot, I mean, I don't know how many million golfers around America. I'm sure there are. How many million people play golf in the United States? 25 million people play golf, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, and on Long Island here too. Like, I mean, that's one of the problems with public golf is that it's a, you know, if you go to Bethpage, right, and you try to play Bethpage Red, or like let's say the Bethpage Red, which is also which is awesome to play, but you're talking about almost 6 hour rounds, Michael. I mean, it's absurd, and so. And that's also part of the problem as well. But, you know, there are people who want to play golf, and they're the same people that are always going to want to play golf. And that's what I'm saying about the, you know, what I was getting back to about growing the game and all that stuff. I mean, listen, what hurts the, you know, the game is people's, the economy, if it's not doing well and people are struggling, then that's going to be a problem. But I mean, the people who want to play are always going to want to play. And it seems to be that number is always going to be relatively the same.
I suspect the biggest difference between where you are and where I am is that private golf seems in New York and around the area, it seems to be so expensive to join a club.
Yes.
Whereas, I mean, Royal Melbourne, which is, you know, I think one of the best, certainly in the top 5 or 10 courses in the world, is the joining fee is about $10,000 and it's about $5,000 a year to play. It's Australian dollars. So that's where. There are about 70 American cents to our dollars, so it's 25% less or a little more, but so it's incredibly cheap, great golf in Australia, whereas in America it seems that it's so expensive to join clubs over there, private clubs.
Well, it's so expensive to, it's not even that, it's so exclusive to the fact that there are some that even if you had the money you couldn't join anyway. So I mean, what does that tell you, you know?
So public golf becomes so much more important in America than it does in Australia.
Sure.
Even though public golf is important in Australia because it's a place that people learn to play, most people finish up joining a club.
Yeah, and, exactly.
I mean, public golf is very rudimentary. You know, there's certainly nothing in the sea like Bethpage or, you know, those amazing public courses in America. But, you know, I mean, it's changed a little in Australia with Bunbury Dunes and King Island and St Andrews Beach. There have been some really good public golf courses built in the last 20 years. But before that, it was rudimentary starting golf, which is not the way public golf is in America. There's some great public golf in America.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, Bethpage alone, I mean, is amazing, a tribute to that, you know. And people shouldn't, you know, the only people who don't live in the area don't know about the rest of the golf courses. I mean, the Red is just beautiful. It's fun, and it's just as, I mean, it's not the Black, but it's the same course in the sense that maybe it has the same kind of, maybe not quite the same scale, but it's just as challenging and just as fun. The Blue course, I would say the front nine of the Blue course is some of Tillinghast's most challenging work too on the property. I mean, it's really, it's fantastic.
I walked the, I walked, I think it was most of the Red when I was there for the Open in 2002. It was terrific. It was fantastic. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, they had also talked about taking that 18th hole off the Red to be the 18th hole of the championship course. They were afraid that because of what they have to do now to the 18th that they're doing for the PGA is they're sort of pinching that some of the landing area with the bunkers. And I mean, Lucas Glover hit 6-iron wedge into 18 in the U.S. in that last U.S. Open, and so what they wanted to do is they wanted to take that they wanted players to walk from the par 3 17th all the way to the 18th of the red, which is sort of like this I don't want to say dog leg, it's really more of like a boomerang really around this sort of big outcropping of rough and stuff. And so so they wanted to, with bunkers on the left obviously around the corner, and so they wanted to take that and make that the 18th of the open, and I guess it just couldn't I don't know what they ended, I don't know why they ultimately decided against it. Maybe they thought the walk was too long, or they just, of course, just hacked out another back tee in the back, which still wasn't long enough, and so they never ended up doing it. But it's, you know, there is great golf on Long Island. I just, you know, I look at it could be so much better if the public was willing to accept. And quite frankly, if people would invest in it, but I think of some 27 hole facilities that you and you know, you and Jeff and Michael and Ashley could have a field day with, if we could just get the people to say, well, first if we had people to invest in it, but if people would say, listen, this is what you should get used to playing. We're going to make this open and wide and fun and firm, and you know, it's not going to be as green as you like, and this is, you don't know that this is good for you, but this is going to be good for you. And that's, you know, that's part of the problem.
I mean, you know, it's such a, you know, in a sense, it's such a pity that a place like Friar's Head is not a public course.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's such an amazing golf course. Yet I assume that so few people see it. Yeah. I mean, if it was 100 years old, it'd be one of the best 5 or 10 courses in America. It's an incredible golf course, I think. Well, it would be ranked as one of the best 5 or 10 courses in America. It's just a brilliant course, but it would be amazing if someone would build something like that. But it was a public golf course that people could play for $50 or $60.
And, yeah,
you know, I'm sure, yeah, it would be a great business.
I would assume. I mean, yeah. I mean, I've never stepped on property at Friar's Head, but everybody has said the same thing that you have, and so. You know, I don't know what the business model, if you could afford to build a place like that on Long Island, I think you probably could. Could you charge, you know, $40-$50 for it, given, you know,
$100, whatever. But,
or whatever, right.
You know, it's the Band and Van Boogel model.
Right.
But can you get the land for a price that you can do that?
I have
no idea what the real estate prices are.
Yeah. Well, I think there are places on Long Island that I think could that could employ, let's say, OCCM and achieve what you're saying, if they were willing to invest. There are some places that I'm thinking of that already exist that could do what you want to do, I think. But I don't, you know, they just have to be willing to take that chance. I mean, that's really what it's coming down to. And I don't know if they're willing to do that.
Yeah. And I suppose the big difference, of course, is that we just take for granted that you play golf 12 months a year. I
mean, right.
You would laugh at us moaning about our cold winters. You guys are kidding.
But, right.
I mean, I've never been in New York in the winter, but I don't imagine it's too much fun. But the golf courses are open, what, for 6 months a year, 7 months a year?
Yeah, if you're lucky, yeah.
Yeah. So of course that's a huge thing to inject into the economics of golf, is that we can play 365 days a year pretty much.
Sure. You mentioned McKenzie, and what would he do? I was just curious, just to transition back to architecture, and if he were alive, if you were going to sit down, if you brought him into your office, and here you, Ogilvy, Cocking, and Mead were sitting around the table, what would that conversation be like? What would you want to ask him?
What would you want to ask him?
You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like
I think I mean, I've read it, you know, in golf architecture, in the spirit of St. Andrews, you know, all the answers to the questions you'll want to ask him are in there.
Right.
I think you would want to, you would take him down and show him your work. And so what do you think? Is it any good or is it? Yeah. And I think he would say, you know, I expected that golf architecture was going to progress after my generation died out, but it clearly never did.
Right.
So, you know, I think he'd be a pretty intimidating guy, but fascinating and gruff and arrogant and sort of, you know, not tolerating fools. So your work would want to be pretty good.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you would, I mean, I would love to take him, because he never, I mean, the thing about his work in Australia, he transformed golf in this country, but he was here for 12 weeks. He worked largely at Royal Melbourne, but they hired him out to other clubs in part to cover their costs.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote reports for a bunch of golf courses.
Mm-hmm.
And the most interesting thing would be for him to come back and see the work, to see how it turned out.
Right.
He built a couple of holes when he was here with Mick Morcombe, who was the greenkeeper at Royal Melbourne, but he came and went in, you know, 2.5 or 3 months and never saw any of it. So I guess the first thing you would do if you came to the office was, let's jump in the car and drive around the corner, literally to Royal Melbourne, which is 5 minutes from our office, and let's take a look and see how it turned out and see if you're happy with it. So that would be my first question would be, how do you think it turned out? You know, mm-hmm. How do you think Morecambe did? And Alex Russell, who was his Australian design partner, former Australian Open champion and great player, who did the East Course at Royal Melbourne, how do you think it turned out? And I think he'd be pretty happy. But, what would be also interesting would be to take him to the other courses he wrote reports for. And he would kind of, there are a few that he would shake his head and say, what the heck happened here?
Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, the Spirit of St. Andrews is such a great book that anyone who wants to understand golf and golf course architecture has to read that book and keep reading it and reread it and pick out all the little gems in that book that really nail how he thought the game was best played. And, you know, for me, I was lucky to play in Europe in the time I played coincided with the best years of Ballesteros. And everyone on that tour, he was their hero. I don't care if it was Nick Faldo or every single player who wasn't Seve wanted to play golf like Seve. And no coincidence that he's the only player ever to have won at Augusta, at St. Andrews, and at Royal Melbourne. And, of course, there have been some great players who have won. Nicklaus and Woods have won at Augusta and Faldo and St. Andrews, but who could have and would have won at Royal Melbourne if they'd played enough there. They just didn't come down and play when there were lots of tournaments at Royal Melbourne. But but Seve was the guy that McKenzie was, I think, designing golf courses for. He wasn't designing for guys who hit the ball straight 260 yards down the fairway and played a Graham Marsh, Halo, and very predictable, fantastic golf, but very mechanic. You know, as Seve called it once, mechanic-type golf.
Right.
You know, he revered the way Walter Hagen played golf. He wrote about that in the Spirit of St. Andrews, watching Hagen play. And without knowing it, he was designing golf and encouraging the golf that Seve Ballesteros played, where you had space off the tee. And if you hit your ball out of position, as we were talking about yesterday, he gave you a chance to recover. But you'd better hit a great shot to recover. And if you mess that one up, then you're in big trouble.
Right.
And that's the essence of Augusta. That's the essence of the Old Course. And that's the essence of St. Andrews. There's lots of space to drive it. If you drive for the wrong place, you've still got a chance. You're not wedging it out of the hay. You've got a chance, but you've got to hit the great shot. And that's what Seve could do. Seve could drive it out of play. And I watched him play pretty much every hole of the 1978 PGA at Royal Melbourne. And he played beautifully. He finished Halo in one. He finished third. And if he hit it out of play or on the wrong side of the fairway, that was when it was most fun to watch him play, because that was when he hit the great shots. I mean, you know, if you put him on the right part of the fairway, he would just hit the standard iron shot on the green within whatever, you know, 10, 15, 20 feet of the hole. But if you put him on the wrong side of the fairway and he was coming from the bad angle across the bunker to the hard green with the wind going the wrong way, that was when he would hit the great shot. That was when it was the most fun watching him play golf, was when he was out of position.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of play that McKenzie wanted to encourage, because the mechanic-type player couldn't play that shot the way Seve could play it.
Yeah, I think that when it comes down to it, I mean, that's really what most people love about Phil Mickelson, right? I mean...
Yeah, exactly. He's very much, you know, the Hagen, Mickelson, Ballesteros, it's very much the same mold of play, who go for the crazy shots, who force or demand that you watch them play because you know you're going to see something special. Tiger as well. I mean, Tiger was he was a genius at that stuff.
Sure. I mean, I don't think anybody who – I don't – when it comes down to it, the height of his powers, I've never seen anybody who was like, I refuse to make bogey more than him. I mean, and I know he did, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, it just seemed like that was his mindset. I refuse to make bogey. And most of the time he didn't.
Yeah. Well, I saw that shot. I was standing with John Huggan, my friend, the Scottish golf writer. We were standing behind Tiger on the 13th fairway at 13th or 14th, the par 5, 13th. The par 5 on Sunday was dark. There'd been that rain delay in 2002, and he hit that 2-iron from 268 yards that flew into the middle of the green. We had press passes, so we were on the fairway. We were probably 30 yards behind him.
Right.
And this thing went – it was a Seve-like shot.
Right.
It was that 1 or 2-iron that just went over the skyscraper.
Yeah.
And it if the green had been 368 yards away, it would have got there. You know, it was just one of those shots that was beyond belief. It was like, you know, I looked at Huggy and said, can you believe that shot? And the thing was still in the air.
Yeah.
It was just the most amazing shot. You know, for a standard shot, it wasn't one of those crazy shots.
Yeah, right. No, I know what you're saying.
It was just a middle of the fairway shot. Mickelson and the group before, I think, had just hit driver 3-wood up 15 yards short of the green. And it was a wet, cold day. It was dark, and it was late. I mean, they finished in the dark on the 18th hole, and it was just the most amazing shot. It was like, oh wow, is that possible? Incredible.
It's crazy. I mean, yeah, I know Huggy well. He's a friend of the program. I have him on all the time, and so he's a fun guy to talk to. But
he is.
What's that?
I like Huggy. He's good.
Yeah, he's a good man. Definitely.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the idea of you guys and Ogilvy and yourself and Cocking and Mead. What is it that each of you you'd say bring to the table? What is it? I know you're more than just a four-man team, obviously, but you guys sort of are the directors, if you will. So I'm just curious if you could just talk a little bit about each of you guys and what you think each brings to the table that makes OCCM so special.
Well, Jeff said to me last year when he was back in Australia, he said, we'd be screwed without these two guys, wouldn't we? I said, yep.
Well, that tells you everything you need to know, right?
Yeah. The original business, Mike Cocking was a good player, engineering student, amateur player in Melbourne, good enough to finish fourth in the Australian Masters behind Colin Montgomery when he was an amateur player. So he was a good player, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me a letter saying, can I come and do some work for you guys? And yeah, we can pay you on an hourly rate. And when he was studying and playing, he came to work for us. And a brilliant guy who learned the business from the ground up, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he understands construction, grassing, timing, building, how to run a project. Ashley worked for John Sloan, who was my partner in the original business. He was the assistant superintendent at Cranbourne, I think, in Melbourne. He came to work for us right around the same time Mike did. So they really both learned the business from the bottom up. In terms of, and they know it way better than I do. And those two guys run all their projects, and they understand every inch of building a golf course, which Jeff and I don't. So Mike and Ashley bring to the table, I think, the ability that Bill Corr has, but being 20 or 30 years younger, how to build beautiful golf. They know that they know how to do that, and the more projects we do, the better they get at it. So that's what they bring to it. Jeff and I, we bring them. I'm not sure what either of us bring to it really, but apart from a philosophy of, I guess it was me and John and Bruce originally, John Sloan and Bruce Grant originally, who formed a philosophy around the way we thought the game was best played. So, our job is to kind of articulate that, talk about that. And when we go to the projects, we all throw in our 10 cents worth as to how we see different holes working, how we see holes changing, how different routings should work. You know, so we all contribute in that way. But, you know, the day-to-day nuts and bolts stuff, you know, the business wouldn't operate without Mike and Ashley because they're great at that stuff. And every business needs people like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a sense, looking back, if I was going to do it again differently, I would have, you know, the day I got into the business, I would have sat down with Bruce Grant and said, okay, teach me how to do this stuff, teach me how to drive the machines and work the machines. But it wasn't what I did, so I never learnt that. You know, I'm always amazed at the skill of a guy like Gil Hans who can go to Rio and come out to Royal Sydney, which is hopefully what he's going to do in the next few years, and build his own work. It just, you know, it amazes me, guys. But I got into it too late to learn that. I was at, you know, rather than sitting on a machine at 20 years old the way Gil was, I was out playing golf in Europe and trying to play professional golf. So that was something I wished I'd learned, but I never did.
Is that the part of the process that fascinates you the most at this point, since you didn't have that sort of apprenticeship, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. I just kind of stick my hands in my pockets and watch and look, and you know, they're the unsung. You know, Kai Golby, Bob Golby's nephew, and you know, guys like that no one's, you know, well, people have heard of them in the business, but you know, they're the guys who are the unsung heroes of golf courses. Brian Schneider, who works for Tom Doak. I mean, those guys who jump on the machines and build that beautiful stuff. I mean, you know, they're the guys that don't get any public credit, but the guys who make golf courses sing, really. They're geniuses at what they do. And it's not the most glamorous job. There's lots of travel, lots of staying in, you know, not the most salubrious places, sitting on machines and noisy machines in cold weather and hot weather and being away from your family and all that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, it's not an easy life. And it takes a certain temperament to do that year after year after year. You have to love what you're doing, and you've got to put up with going out in a machine and building a bunker and someone coming along and saying, no, go and do it again. And so there are lots of, you know, it takes a certain temperament to do that. It takes a lot of skill. It takes a lot of patience. You know. But those guys love what they're doing, and they're great at it. And you know, if you spoke to Bill Kaur, you know, he would tell you how much respect he has for those guys and how much credit he gives them and how important they are to the golf courses that Bill and Ben do.
I don't think it's definitely doesn't strike me as a profession that you can sort of fake your way around it. You know, it's pretty,
you can't.
It's just too hard. It's just too difficult. Like you said, it's not, there's nothing celebrity about it.
Well, not that part of it. I mean, and I think fortunately the age of, and kind of, you know, perhaps me talking as a golf pro and Jeff as a golf pro, but you know, I think the era of the celebrity ribbon cutting golf pro designers coming to an end. I think the biggest and most respected guys in the business aren't famous players anymore, but the, you know, it's Bill Kaur and Tom and Gil Hans and Mike DeVries and guys like that who are the, you know, they're the big names in the business now because they're the guys who are doing the best golf courses. So you know, the era of the pro who turns up three times and cuts the ribbon and signs the contract and shakes hands with the owner are over. So if pros want to get into the business, they've got to be prepared to work in it, I think.
Yeah.
I think Jeff's probably going to come back and live in Australia next year and certainly get more involved in the business.
Right.
So, you know, that's going to be his role, I think, once he's finished up playing. And it's always, I mean, Jeff's not having a great year this year, so it's always... You know, it's not my place to call the curtain on his career because, you know, I think he's got lots of good golf left to play. But,
yeah,
you know, where he goes after this year, his exemption runs out. He's way down the main list this year. You know, he needs to get in. You know, if he wants to keep playing in America, he needs to start playing some good golf pretty quickly.
Right.
So he's 40 years old. Coincidentally, it's pretty much the same time I finished. The age I was when I stopped playing golf, and he's clear, you know, a much better player than I was. But you know, it's an interesting time for pro golfers at 40. You know, he's been a pro for 20 years now. He's, you know, his kids are at school age and growing up, and you know, his eldest daughter's a teenager in October. So it's a, you know, he's lived away from Melbourne for 20 years now. So it's an interesting time for him. And in terms of how he transitions into the next part of his life.
I always thought that. Sorry, go on. Yeah, I was going to say, I always thought that obviously he's very talented. There's no question about it. But I always thought he was, I felt like he was too smart for the PGA Tour to play golf. I almost feel like the PGA Tour on a regular basis wasn't really intellectually challenging enough for him. You know, I just feel like he, you know, it's not inspiring. You know, he seems like a guy who, you know, he gets it. He knows what golf should be, and to be forced to eat McDonald's all the time, I would think it's sort of got to be, you know, it's got to wear on you.
Yeah, I think he's, in a sense, look, I don't know. I haven't really spoken to him about it, but I suspect he's kind of bored with it a little bit. You know, he's made a lot of money. He's financially secure. His kids are great. His marriage is great. He's got a great job back here if he wants to get, you know, get involved in it. So, you know, it's a time when he's going to make those decisions. But, I love playing. I suspect I love playing more than he did. But if Jeff could pick a schedule out and play at Walton Heath and Royal Melbourne and Sunningdale and Hirono in Japan and, you know, the play Colonial or Trinity Forest, which the course they're playing this week, and pick the eyes out of a great worldwide schedule where he could play 15 tournaments a year, that would be my dream tour. I don't know if he would like to do that. I think perhaps he'd say that Carl can't be bothered.
Right.
But, you know, if Jeff could go and play 10 or 15 tournaments a year on great courses, I think he would probably enjoy that. But they don't play at Sunningdale anymore, or Walton Heath, or Hirono, or, you know, so it's, you know, it's even difficult to go around the world and pick out, you know, your 12 dream events that you might be able to get invitations to play in. It's hard to pick them out because it's not what pro golf does. Pro golf goes where there's money.
Sure.
And money and great architecture don't necessarily go together.
They definitely don't. Well, I got to wrap things up here, Mike. I want to thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
And no, it's been great, Anthony. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's just always good to. It's always fun and interesting to me. I don't, you know, I'm just getting into this sort of architecture type of things. I had an experience, you know, my first experience was the one and only time I played National Golf Links, playing that, and then walking it for the Walker Cup, which. Wasn't necessarily the same thing, me playing and them playing it, but just looking around, that was my introduction to, you know, wonderful or classical golf architecture. So it's, for me, it's really a pleasure to talk to you to sort of get inside the minds of how people think and what is it that they value when they're creating a golf course. So thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Anthony. And, you know, you're lucky to be living so close to that place. It's, you know, it's a bit like me. I kind of have to just make myself aware that I'm right around the corner from Royal Melbourne, and being right around from the corner from Royal Melbourne or the National Golf Links is a, you know, it's a privilege for people who live close to places like that, because they're such amazing places to play golf and such great examples of what, you know, the best of golf. They're incredible places.
Yeah, no, they are, and I don't take it for granted, and I'm grateful for people who do have. Who have more regular access than I. I've played it once, but it was, but you only really need to play it once. Don't get me wrong. You can play it a million times to appreciate it. But if you're in the right time in your life and where you're sort of willing to, when you're ready to accept things like that, I think then you really, to see it once is enough for you to really sort of get it. I mean, after that is just appreciation, and your levels of appreciation. But I definitely wouldn't mind wanting to see it a few more times, but I get to see it enough with pictures, and I remember it's amazing how just seeing one picture that people post from their rounds there, and I remember exactly where I was on that hole and exactly the shot I hit. We're very lucky. We're very spoiled in that way.
You are. We all are.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you very much, and I really look forward to speaking with you down the road. I really would like to have you on again.
Anytime. Thanks, mate.
All right. Take care. All right. Okay. That was
bye.
That was Michael Clayton from OCCM on the part two of our radio show segment that we had together, and that will be it for today. Have a great day, people. All right, Mike. You good?
Okay. All good, mate.